When I ran for office, I pledged to stand for life. And as president, that's exactly what I've done. And I have kept my promise, and I think everybody here understands that fully.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was President Donald Trump speaking at the Susan B. Anthony List annual gala on Tuesday night. Thanks to Trump's words and actions, the anti-abortion movement is racking up a string of victories. And that's our focus on today's Pulse Check. First, I'll be joined by my colleague Jennifer Habercorn, who's tracked these issues, has a big news story out on the anti-abortion movement. And then I sat down with Marjorie Dannenfelser, the head of Susan B. Anthony List, who joined Trump on stage and has become one of his key supporters after being one of his biggest critics. If you stick around to the end of the episode, you'll also hear our latest Steal My Job segment, where Marjorie talks about her experience building an advocacy organization. Some quick housekeeping notes. We've had a string of especially great interviews, including HHS Secretary Alex Azar and Medicare expert John Gorman. You can find those episodes by scrolling up in the podcast feed. And if you're interested in a different perspective on abortion issues, we spoke recently with guests like Equity Forward's Mary Alice Carter, who used to work at Planned Parenthood. I'll link to those episodes in the show notes. And we don't usually do this, but I wanted to give you a peek at an upcoming episode. Next week, we're planning to focus on Juul, the popular e-cigarette. And if you haven't read this month's New Yorker article on Juul and vaping, I might suggest it as a homework assignment. As usual, you can find Pulse Check on all of your favorite podcast apps. You can find me at ddiamond@politico.com for suggestions. And with that, here's my conversation with Politico's Jen Habercorn. I'm joined again on Politico Pulse Check by Jen Habercorn, our ace Congress reporter, who also is our lead reporter on reproductive health care. Jen, welcome back.
Thanks, Dan.
With our new colleague, Chris Catalago, you wrote a crackling story, How Anti-Abortion Forces Learned to Love Trump. If this was the Date Lab column, this was not love at first sight. Anti-abortion folks were alarmed by Trump 2 years ago. Now they're celebrating him. Is it as simple as he's delivering for them? Or would they have supported any Republican president?
This is definitely the former. I mean, if you think back to 2016, they were literally saying, pick anybody but Trump, because every other Republican in the primary field was saying, you know, I'm passionately against abortion. Here are all the reasons. And then Trump was out there kind of just being like, yeah, sure. But there was a record of him saying that he was very pro-choice back in 1999. The difference came when he came out in the election and said, there are four concrete promises that I will do. One of them being, I will appoint pro-life judges to the Supreme Court. And that was huge. No Republican candidate had ever promised that explicitly. And that was one of the key things that convinced the anti-abortion groups to get on board with the president. If you think about it, conservatives are much better at playing long ball. They realize the importance of the Supreme Court and judges at the lower levels. I mean, Trump has appointed 21 judges to the appellate court level, which is double the pace Obama had at this point in his presidency. And that's going to have such a lasting effect. Those are lifetime appointments. And when you think about the Supreme Court, if he is able to nominate someone to one of the, you know, so-called liberal seats right now, that is a fifth vote to potentially overturn Roe versus Wade, which is the key goal of the anti-abortion movement. So all of that came together to convince them to get behind President Trump.
And that's one reason why Susan B. Anthony List and other groups have targeted the midterms, because they say we need Congress to be on the president's side. We need the Senate to be Republican to get these candidates through into the judiciary and possibly all the way to the Supreme Court. You were at the gala on Tuesday night celebrating Donald Trump, where he came out on stage and Marjorie, the head of SBA List, said he's the most pro-life president ever. What was the atmosphere in the room? How much energy was there around the president?
Oh, there was a lot of energy. It was at the National Building Museum, a very beautiful building downtown Washington. And everyone was very excited. The president had never appeared at one of their events before. And I don't think many presidents have appeared at any of these kind of gala annual events of the anti-abortion groups. So it's a very big deal. He came in to huge applause. There are lots of applause lines. He kind of pointed out every single member of Congress in the room, and each one got a funny little mention and big applause. Everyone was very excited. They feel like they're at their apex right now. That they've had all these regulatory wins. They have Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. They feel like this is their moment, and they just need to make sure it keeps going. And it's funny because, thinking about all the ways that they could move forward with their agenda, they've gotten nothing through Congress. The Senate is still 49, so-called pro-life votes, 51 pro-choice votes. They can't move any legislation. But with Trump in the White House, he can do a lot through regulatory action.
And one of those actions happened just hours before Trump took the stage at the Susan B. Anthony List Gala. The administration finally released its changes to the Title 10 program. This is the family planning program, hundreds of millions of dollars. You've done extensive reporting on not just what it means, but how the Trump administration has changed the administration of these funds. What is in the new announcement, Jen?
So there's two main things in the new announcement. It would prohibit anyone who gets Title 10 funds from having a physical or financial relationship with an abortion provider. So you think about a woman's health clinic. They do Title 10, in some parts of their business and provide abortion services in another part of their business. That would not be allowed. So that would directly target a place like Planned Parenthood. But there's other facilities as well that do things like that. The other thing is that Title 10 grantees cannot make a referral to an abortion provider. Both of those things would really prohibit anyone who does abortion services from getting Title 10 money.
And that's led to criticism from groups like Planned Parenthood, other reproductive health groups, abortion rights groups that say this is a, quote, gag rule. The abortion rights activists even came out on Tuesday night and projected no gag rule on all the buildings around where Trump was speaking. So he would see that when walking out, the projections on the walls. Is this a gag rule, Jen, based on every traditional definition of what it means to gag providers from talking about care?
Well, there's one thing that this rule doesn't do that the Reagan era rule did. This was modeled off a rule that Reagan tried to do, which would prohibit counseling on abortion. But this is a gag rule in that it prohibits the referral for abortion. And that has a lot of the abortion rights groups very concerned, because if you are telling a provider that you can't say something to a patient, no matter what that is, in this case, it's a referral for an abortion, they say that that's, one, ironically enough, the government interfering between the patient-provider relationship. And, this is definitely going to go to court. We haven't had a lawsuit filed yet, but the rule is not final yet. And it's going to be really interesting because a similar rule did go to the Supreme Court in the late 1980s during the Reagan administration, and it was upheld. And so that has given the anti-abortion groups a lot of confidence that this would be upheld as well. Whether it's going to be the same thing now, we don't know.
I think with the gag rule issue, it is a little bit of eye of the beholder in that anti-abortion groups say it is a gag rule. Abortion rights groups say this is misleading. The timing was funny in that HHS was announcing this or planning to last week at the same time as CMS was arguing that there shouldn't be any gag rule on a totally separate issue. Pharmacists who share drug pricing information with patients, and Seema Verma on Twitter was saying we would never support a gag rule of any kind. And people kind of piled on her for the seeming irony of that. There is another regulatory change that Trump made that you scooped, which is the administration of Title 10 funds. And Valerie Huber, someone who has been outspoken about abstinence, is now in a key position to administer these funds. We'll link to that story in the show notes, but could you quickly describe what that change is?
Yeah, we should say these changes announced yesterday are in proposed rules.
The changes to the Title 10 funds.
Right. And so those won't go into effect right away. They probably won't go into effect till the next funding announcement. The rules that the administration announced a couple months ago were more preliminary, but one of the key things in that announcement, that kind of we should think of that as the starting point to where the administration wants to go with Title 10. But one of the key changes that happened earlier this year is that Valerie Huber is going to have final say as to who gets a Title 10 grant. And in the past, that was a decision made by several people at HHS here in Washington, as well as people regionally. Now she'll have that final say.
And Valerie Huber is the HHS official who oversees the Office of Population Affairs.
Yeah, that's right.
You've made the point that the agenda of anti-abortion groups has been stalled in Congress. That's one reason why they're trying to mobilize so much momentum around the midterms, a message that Donald Trump stepped on somewhat last night. How much is abortion going to be a midterm election issue, Jen? Or is this just something that these groups want to be an issue and maybe it won't be?
I do think it will be because it fits into the broader agenda of what Democrats are going to say about Donald Trump is that they're undermining important social institutions like healthcare. Women's health is a part of that. I think we're definitely going to see all these changes that the administration has made and all the places the administration has signaled they want to go, such as defunding Planned Parenthood, that it's going to be an issue. And, you know, on the anti-abortion side, the argument's going to be, look at what Trump has done already. And we're going to try to continue that by giving him a Senate that has a majority of anti-abortion voters.
As you look forward to the rest of this year, Jen, are there other big signposts on abortion rights that you are tracking?
Oh, well, I mean, number one, I mean, this would change the course of everybody's year if there is a Supreme Court appointment. I mean, because that appointment, even if it's not for one of the so-called liberal seats, if it's one of the conservative seats, it's going to be enormous. It's going to reshape the entire year.
Is it possible to have a Supreme Court appointment ahead of an election anymore? I mean, is the new rule that we have to wait until after the election happens?
Well, I certainly think that's going to be one of the arguments.
I'm sure Merrick Garland has some thoughts on this.
Yes.
So the seats that you're thinking of could be the older liberal judges, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, but also the possibility of a conservative seat?
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of speculation around Justice Kennedy, who's the perennial swing vote. He's a Reagan appointee who has made rulings in support of abortion rights. I feel like there's just annually rumors of him, his pending retirement every June. So I don't put a ton of weight into that. But I do think like in a Supreme Court appointment is just going to not only bring this issue into such a strong spotlight ahead of the election, it's just going to change everybody's year.
We will look forward to your reporting on all of these issues and we hope to have you back soon. Thanks as always, Jen.
Thanks, Dan.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
And I'm proud to be.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Marjorie. Thank you, Marjorie, for that wonderful introduction. All my friends are out.
You introduced the president on stage. The eyes of the world were on your event. And Susan B. Anthony List is spending more than it ever has, I think, on lobbying. Mm-hmm. You're on track for almost $1 million this year. Where does this moment rank in the 2-decade-plus history of this organization under you?
Well, we're on the cusp of making history. That's where we are. Not since 1973, Roe versus Wade, has there been a more significant moment, a more pivotal moment to change things. We're really one Supreme Court justice away from allowing states and the nation to pass laws that reflect our own values about life, and that is huge.
Is this the strongest position that Susan B. Anthony List has ever been in?
This is the strongest position the pro-life movement has been in since 1973.
There are listeners who think you save lives. The model and actress Kathy Ireland, who introduced you on stage last night, said you're her hero. Then there are listeners who don't trust what you might have to say. They say that you're taking away their access to reproductive health care. What would you say to them?
Well, one thing I would say is that the me now is the anti-hero to me about 20 years ago when I was very strongly pro-choice. I can see why people feel the way they do when they see me and my very large organization activating and mobilizing pro-life people to win elections. I really had a change of heart that really the nation is has led and is also following. And that change of heart was from seeing the thing happening in a pregnancy is about a child. And what happens during an abortion is the end of that child's life. If that's what you think is happening in abortion, then you really change every way that you look at this issue. You do something. You think that people are dying every day, and you do anything that you can to address the problems in the woman's life that are leading to that and try to save the child's life. So that's what I would say to me a long time ago, who was very strongly pro-choice, who said, my body, my choice, in answer to anyone who tried to get in my way. But my heart changed.
If life begins at conception, why not fight for a total ban on abortion? Your group has focused more on just the 20-week limit.
Well, the great thing about American democracy is it depends upon consensus. Where we have consensus in this nation now is arguably maybe around 16 weeks or 20 weeks, where people think after that point is really not humane. We can see that it's a human being after that. It looks like it. It, you know, has eyebrows, eyelashes. You can sing to your baby, and you're taught at that time in pregnancy, mothers are told to do things that you do with a human, not with a clump of cells. So for whatever reason, that consensus is around that time, around 16, 20 weeks. That's the sweet spot. That's where we legislate, because that's where we have a mandate.
The legislation that you've supported, the 20-week pain-capable act, that's one of multiple priorities that you have for this administration and for lawmakers. So the four big ones, if you could just run us through them.
Sure. So the four commitments that candidate Trump made and our top priorities are the 20-week bill, that pain-capable bill, to make the Hyde Amendment permanent, to defund Planned Parenthood, the largest abortion provider in the nation, and to nominate only pro-life Supreme Court justices. Those are the four.
We live in a world of camps where partisans fall down on either side. Is it more important for a group like yours to craft a message that wins over skeptics or plays to your supporters?
Both. That's really a great question, and that is what our door-to-door strategy is. And when we're in these Senate races and we're going door-to-door to get out the vote for our candidate, we look at the people who are already with us who might not have voted if they didn't hear what was at stake, you know, really just make sure the contrast is very clear. But we also go to the Hispanics, the Democrats, the Independents, who are also with us but really not getting that information from anybody except for Planned Parenthood or our opponents. Campaign. So it's really important, those persuadables, those folks who are pretty much with us, to go ahead.
How many people are really persuadable, though, on an issue like abortion that is so deeply felt? Are we talking about 10% of the electorate might be persuadable, 5%?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right that a lot of this is on the margins. Most people aren't really forced to think about it, you know, unless it has an instance in your life has forced you to think about it. And so we're in the business of kind of helping people clarify what do they actually think.
You're forcing them to think about it.
Yeah, we are. And because we think it's that important. So what I really think is that since there's probably about 5% on both sides that are like, absolutely, abortion for any point, for any reason, up until birth. And then there's about, you know, 6% or so that say no abortions from conception. But then everybody else left in the middle is not really sure exactly where they are. Almost all are against late-term abortion. So that's where we make it a really important political issue so that we can at least pass that.
You mentioned that you worked for a Democrat who was for abortion rights. And there are precious few of those left. Dan Lipinski from Illinois, who your group worked to help stay in office, is one of the only Democrats still in Congress who's anti-abortion. If this is an issue that really does cross over to both parties, why aren't there more congressional Democrats who are anti-abortion?
Well, unfortunately, it's because of the extreme polarization of this issue. I'm really not for the polarization of this issue for the exact reason that you just said. 20 years ago, we would not have won any vote in the U.S. House of Representatives if it weren't for about 28 pro-life Democrats. And they were real pro-life Democrats, not just, you know, check the box, okay, I don't want to get my people back home mad. They were the cardinals of the appropriations committees. They were very powerful men and women. What happened was Obama. When he that the surge that elected him and his presidency really made really set down a contrast that the Democratic Party could not sustain when it came to the pro-life issue. If you're not for abortion rights, then you may not be a candidate in our party. You cannot be, maybe you can get away with being a state legislator or a lower court or down there, but back home, but you're not going to be on the federal stage.
So you don't think that President Clinton or President George W. Bush was similarly strong on abortion issues?
Clinton was trying to thread the needle. He often said that it was uncomfortable, it was complicated. Of course, he's not for it, but you know, a lot of language around the issue. Obama, not at all. President Obama felt this was a human rights issue. That is the clarifying distinction. We believe it's a human rights issue for the unborn child. He believed it was a human rights issue because the woman should have mastery over her own body. So when the polls are that extreme, then you have, and that is a setup for one party owning it and one party disowning it. But what it does is it disenfranchises about a third of Democrats across the country, and Hispanics and Independents who do not agree with that dramatically polarized view that the Democratic Party holds.
You famously criticized Donald Trump in the 2016 campaign, and now you've embraced him. Was there a moment that you can point to where you said, this is our guy, I can trust him?
I can. It was very difficult. I, like everyone, rejected the content of those comments. I was very offended. I was offended on behalf of my daughters and offended on behalf of women. Yeah, I did not like it. There was a point, however, yes, where I found the choice to be very clear. There was a woman who embraced a human rights perspective on abortion that was antithetical to humanity, in my view, who really wanted abortion up until the end. And then candidate Trump.
You're talking about Hillary Clinton, to be clear.
clarify her, not just her. She has a name. And on the other hand, candidate Trump, who made very strong pro-life commitments. When he asked me to be the director of his pro-life effort in the battleground states, I said, I'll consider it if you agree to these concrete commitments. So you have concrete commitments that are pro-life on one hand. You have concrete commitments that are pro-abortion, in my perspective, on the other. And it became a very clear policy choice. And that was the one that I had to make.
So just to underline, the moment that Trump won you over was when he signed on to those four commitments of defunding Planned Parenthood, electing judges who would be against abortion, and so on and so on. Given Trump's history of making statements and then walking back from them, how confident were you when he said this during the campaign that he would actually follow through?
Well, at that point, the context also made it better. We had Kellyanne Conway, we had David Bossie, we had Mark Short. There are a lot of people that were in the campaign that were clear indications that this was the policy direction that he planned to go.
You're mentioning prominent Republican strategists who had worked on anti-abortion issues.
That's right, and people that I had worked with before and in the past. And in politics, sometimes, and in fact, a lot of times, that's what you have to do. You see it on paper, you see that commitment reflected in the people that you know, and you make a strong decision. Not deciding is death in politics. You must decide and go with the best shot that you have. And that's exactly what I did.
And then when Mike Pence joined the ticket, that was even more confirmation for you.
That's right. I mean, clearly, Pence, who I had been trying to get to run for president himself many years ago, clearly one of my closest friends in politics and somebody I admire very much, his thinking was very similar. We were going through some of the same thoughts about the ticket. We weren't talking about it, but I know we were thinking about the same thing, and it seemed very, very obvious. So I was mistaken in my early comments, in the very beginning of the primary, that this is somebody that we couldn't trust. And it's one of my favorite mistakes. I am very happy to own that. And I'm very happy that we made the decision that we did, because history is changing, because this man is keeping his promises.
This is a president who's been married three times. There's evidence that he's had affairs. Is there anything that Donald Trump could do in his personal life that would shake your support of him?
Well, I don't know what those things would be. I think the things that you've mentioned are things in the past. I always accept converts. I'm a convert myself. I think that's what we ought to be in the business of doing. I think it would have to come down to the premise of the choice that I described a little while ago. Will more people die because of a decision that he's making? And I can't foresee that happening. I'm just saying that the premise has to be the same. It has to be surrounding human life. So that's how I really look at it.
In the 2016 campaign, the New York Times' Maureen Dowd asked Donald Trump if he had been involved with a woman who had had an abortion. He dodged the question. Later, he walked it back and said, no, I didn't. But if it came out that Donald Trump helped a woman get an abortion, would that change your position on him?
I would handle it exactly the way I would handle anybody that I've ever known or anybody that I will know if I heard something like that. I would go, I would sit down, I would talk with them, I would hear what happened. The circumstances matter. I think the objectification of people in politics is a mistake, and it makes people cynical about the process. I think every person that we deal with in politics is just as human as you and I sitting here. So I would want to know the circumstances, and I would take it from there.
You are a fan of the Trump administration. How often are you getting to go to the White House? Donald Trump mentioned on stage that he sees you around and you've advised him.
I go there pretty often. My goal was to go there more than Cecile Richards ever did. She was there. I mean, it's kind
under
of a joke.
Obama.
Kind
yeah.
of a joke. Under Obama.
Cecile Richards, the head of Planned Parenthood.
That's right.
Yeah.
And
she's not visiting Donald Trump right
she's
now.
She's not
the White House.
Visiting Donald Trump in her retirement. I'm sure she's not. The goal, really, more than number of visits, is to be a true partner in advancing life. And it takes showing up where they work in order to do that. So I go as often as I can.
So like once a week, once a month?
Once every couple of weeks.
And you're not always meeting with the president. You're meeting with the people around
sure,
the president.
Sure. The people I'm mostly talking to are the people who are really up on the Hill working strategy or people who are interested in winning some Senate races.
What are the next regulatory actions that you want to see out of the Trump administration, given that Congress is somewhat stalled on moving on anti-abortion issues?
I'll be very honest with you. My primary focus, what we're going to go to sleep at night thinking about and getting up in the morning planning for, is winning these Senate seats, because our agenda is pretty much blocked until we get a few more senators. Now, the one exception would be if we get a Supreme Court nominee, and then it's no holds barred. We're all in.
The president last night at your gala suggested that maybe the 2018 election isn't as important as the 2016 election.
So your vote in 2018 is every bit as important as your vote in 2016. Although I'm not sure I really believe that, but, you know. I don't know who the hell wrote that line. I'm not sure. But it's still important, remember.
Is he wrong?
Well, I think that was a good laugh line, because, of course, the election he was in is obviously the most important election. I think, you know, everybody in the political business always says this is the most important election in history. And I'm one of those people who says that. but it is a building process. I mean, it sounds like I'm evading your question, but I'm really not. We wouldn't be in this position if he hadn't won. But now that we're in this position, we are on the verge of making history. The next Supreme Court justice will decide Roe versus Wade one way or the other, and that is premised on what this Senate looks like.
Let me flip this around. So your organization has said, we need our supporters to get out and vote for these anti-abortion candidates. But now Trump has 2 years of history of making and taking action that has infuriated Planned Parenthood and its supporters. Is there a chance that the abortion issue will go in favor of Democrats in the upcoming midterms?
Well, here's what we found. A couple of things. One is we always had the gut instinct that the pro-life movement had far more intensity than the pro-choice movement on the ground. It's had a long time to build. It just is deeper and wider. It's more organic. It's a little bit Trump-like in its nature. We tested that theory by doing all the programs that we do on the ground now, and we were right. The theory is true, and we've also found that there is far less intensity on the ground in terms of real people, everyday people, and less intensity in the pro-choice movement. So I think that who is activated are a lot of women's groups who don't like Trump, but they're not necessarily all about abortion. They're about a whole lot of other issues. So I would never deny that there is intensity on that. That worries us, of course, because it's just going to be a battle of intensity. I don't think it'll be an abortion backlash. I think it'll be perhaps other issues.
Who are your top targets in this year's midterms? Who are you trying to get out of office?
Sherrod Brown.
The Ohio Democrat.
Claire McCaskill in Missouri. John Tester in Montana. Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Bill Nelson in Florida, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota. That's a long list. Right now, we are in Florida, Ohio, Indiana, and Missouri. And we've been in those first two for over a year. We've just been, and so we're, it's a rollout. And the next place we'll go is West Virginia with Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp, North Dakota. Because now we have candidates. Our candidates on the other side. It's not just now about defining the incumbent. It's going to be about also defining the person who wants to unseat that incumbent.
Who's a candidate that you're especially excited about?
Well, we really like Governor Scott of Florida. We think he's fantastic. He is an articulate defender of life. He's been involved with Susan B. Anthony List building in Florida before. We love Congressman Kramer from North Dakota. I think he is so of his people. She, Heidi Heitkamp, has really voted the opposite direction, in the opposite direction of the people of North Dakota. It's a great contrast. He's well-liked there. He's got a wide radio listenership all over the state. That's going to be a really fun one. I have to say that Claire McCaskill is as motivating to me to defeat as I am supportive of Josh Hawley, who I love.
What about Claire McCaskill?
Claire McCaskill is should have been in, well, we worked very hard in that race 6 years ago to prevent her from being a U.S. senator, and because it was a very tough year for Republicans in that presidential year, and so she won despite the odds. So we've always thought we were really looking forward to another chance to upset her designs on her state, and we think we've got a great chance. I mean, she's one of the top targets in the nation for everyone, including us.
You've referenced several times the pro-life movement, and not everyone may know this, but at Politico and at some other news outlets, we don't say pro-life or pro-choice. We say anti-abortion or abortion rights. Using your own nomenclature, though, pro-life, how far does that extend? What sorts of policies, even beyond abortion, would you say are necessary to preserve the sanctity of life?
I hope you don't mind, because I would like to comment on the labels. I always say pro-choice because I think it's an act of respect for somebody who calls themselves pro-choice. So I call myself pro-life because that is the issue that I am working on. I'm not working anti-abortion. I'm working for pro-life.
Well, abortion rights groups would take issue with claiming the pro-life mantle because that's a powerful terminology.
Sure. And then I could take a certain issue that this is not about choice, because we could be talking about vanilla and chocolate with choice. We're talking about the life of a human being. So,
and I think that's it's for those reasons that we try and stay away from the news perspective and just stick to abortion rights and anti-abortion.
You know, the labels honestly don't really matter that much. What matters is the content of what we're doing. There's no question about that. And you asked a minute ago about where does pro-life extend. For the Susan B. Anthony List and me personally, that extends from conception until natural death. And there's a lot in between in terms of honoring life and the true life, meaning life and death, not all the quality of life issues that could be thrown in the between birth and death. You know, some of the issues might not be as obvious because they're not really reported upon, but a whole lot. But one of them is abortions that are really, they're self-abortions. They're medical abortions with a pill, alone, in a bathroom, unsupervised, and deeply disturbing and upsetting to women and not safe.
Though the abortion rights groups would counter and say this is why there needs to be a Planned Parenthood in every community, so there's a safer way to seek out abortion, which is legal under our current law.
Yes, they would say that, but we would say you've got, in every single abortion, you've got two people who have deep needs, a woman and an unborn child, and we're there to serve them both.
Getting back to the broader question of sanctity of life, what about gun control? There are 30,000 plus gun-related deaths every year. If the focus is to preserve life, shouldn't there be a ban on guns?
There are 10 or 15 other issues that we could take on if we were going to move out from this central question of whether you get to live or die in this nation. It is, you know, a very clear choice when you're first conceived, somebody's going to allow you to be born or not. We think that's a big enough issue to take on, and I don't think that it undercuts or impugns our integrity in any way to only go after the question, do you get to live or die in this nation at birth?
And so gun issues, that's not something you think about.
I guess that was a long way of saying, no, we're not involved in gun issues.
Your gala is over, the Title X announcement is out, and now we've got 6 months away, the midterms. Are there other events, announcements, things that are going to happen in the next 6 months that Susan B. Anthony List is building its agenda around?
About 5,000 events a day, and that is the event of a canvasser showing up at a door to talk to a voter to encourage them to vote for our candidate. I mean, that is really the most important thing that we could be doing from now until Election Day.
Well, Marjorie Dannenfelser, we'll be checking in with you ahead of the election, and thank you for joining Politico Pulse Check.
I look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Marjorie Dannenfelser of SBA List and Jen Habercorn for joining the conversation, and also to Micaela Rodriguez for producing the episode. You can find Pulse Check on all of your favorite podcast apps. Rate it, review it, share it with a friend. We always look at Apple Podcast reviews. Please keep them coming. You can find me at ddiamond at politico.com with suggestions. And you can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week. So Marjorie is now back for the latest edition of Steal My Job, how influential people in Washington and beyond got to where they are. And Marjorie, what I wanted to ask you about is the building of Susan B. Anthony List. When you arrived 25 years ago, it was a small organization. It was basically run out of your house. You did not take the path that many young ex-congressional staffers did to Heritage Foundation or Brookings. What I'm curious about, is that the right path for everyone to take, to start at a small organization rather than go to a big one?
Well, I think the real question is, what is my next step? I remember asking that of people that I respected at the time, what should I be doing? What's my next step? And the answer that I got back from actually Adam Meyerson, who was at Heritage Foundation a long time ago, he said, well, what's missing? What needs to be done? And that has stuck with me all this time. I did like to write. You know, I was a philosophy major. I thought I was smarter than everybody else. I needed to let everybody know what my thoughts were, and I would write them down so everybody could read them. That was being done by people smarter than me, you know. What I did see missing was there was no political arm of the pro-life movement. There was no political arm of the most important human rights issue of our day, in my opinion. And I also believed very strongly there were not enough women speaking out on this issue, and they were being kind of closeted off and shamed away from speaking. So I started with the most ridiculous way, with hardly any money, a really great idea, a few people, including Henry Hyde, who thought it was a good idea, and just started raising money for candidates. I picked the one thing that I thought would be smart, which would be to raise money for some candidates so they knew exactly where that money was coming from, so then they could help build. So I would recommend only start small as an organizational entrepreneur if you think something isn't already being done. But if you do see something already being done, how will it be done better? Think like an entrepreneur. How can this thing that I already really like be better, and try to pursue that?
What if that leads to 200 new advocacy organizations, maybe even ones that are anti-abortion? Is that a good outcome?
It could be, but market forces will filter out the ones that don't really work. And we certainly see that, and we see it in the marketplace of ideas. We see it in the marketplace in commerce. We see it everywhere. So that doesn't worry me. In fact, I really do think sometimes when people challenge you, meaning we got a direct opposition, somebody's doing just what we're doing, but they think they're going to do it better, I like that. Because frankly, it makes us really stretch ourselves. It helps us whittle down, okay, what do we essentially do that nobody else does? Maybe we can stop doing some of those other things and make sure that we are always exactly where we need to be.
What do you know now about building an advocacy organization that you wish you knew when you were starting out?
I wish that I knew how important seed money was. But then I say to myself, should I really have known that? Because it might have kept me from starting.
What do you mean by that? That you didn't realize how important it was to get funding?
Yeah.
And how scary that would have been when you were just starting?
Yeah, I think if I had thought, you know, you really shouldn't start without a $500,000 grant from someone. I don't know, I might not have ever been able to do that, so I might not have ever started. What I did start with was what I had, which wasn't much. But the most important thing that did come my way was the human piece, the human resources, the people that were willing to chip in and do things for free all along the way. So I'm not really sure. I actually really do think what's true is that you do start with everything that you know in the best way you can, and you just adapt as you go along and try to get better along the way.
You've been doing this for 25 years.
And I'm only 27, which is amazing.
You're wearing it well. How much longer do you think you will be at SBA List? Is it another 25 years in this role?
Well, I work really hard to bring up really sharp young women and men to take my place. And when that day is obvious, there'll be a lot of people stepping into my role. But it's not obvious quite yet.
This was really good. Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you.